Coming off our conversation in the last hour about Oprah Winfrey's pop spirituality, you'll hear words like prayer and meditation and even devotion from people who buy into that kind of pop spirituality. What is prayer really? What is devotion? What is meditation really from a biblical perspective? Well, a resource in that direction is our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June called A Lutheran Book of Prayer. This is newly reissued and revamped. It has prayers from the 16th century Reformation all the way up to the present day. Not your typical Christian prayer book, where you might get, 150 pages of Christian prayers or of prayers, perhaps even a book about prayer, where Jesus is seldom mentioned, or where Jesus is not mentioned as the reason God hears and answers prayer. Well, the Lutheran Book of Prayer is different in that respect, Christ-centered and cross-focused. It's $8.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. You've got about 50 minutes to do it during this last 50 minutes. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, A Lutheran Book of Prayer, or find out more about the book at our website, issuesetc.org. The book is right there on the homepage. Here in the second hour of the program, three guests, three topics. We're going to be talking with Chris Mino of the Massachusetts Family Institute. You may have seen this in USA Today or elsewhere. Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney has announced support for a proposed constitutional amendment in that state banning both same-sex marriage and civil unions. We'll be talking about that here for the next 10 minutes. Eric Wilford will join us of the Crusade for Life Walk. This is a protest at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops meeting in Chicago over pro-choice Catholic lawmakers, a subject we've discussed many times here on Issues Etc. That's coming up in just a few minutes. And then to round off the second hour of the program today, we're going to discuss polygamy. Robbie Sweeten, he's got a strange situation in his life. The mother of Robbie's 4-year-old daughter has entered a plural marriage to an independent polygamist in Utah. We hear all about the big ones. We hear about, who's this guy that's so much in the news now, Warren Jeffs? We hear about those. What about the little ones? What about the people who are practicing polygamous marriage that never make the news or don't have a cult following behind them? We'll talk about that there in the third hour of the program. Open lines for your questions and your comments. I've got two questions for you. Okay, the first one has to do with this girl who has sadly disappeared and probably met with foul play in Aruba. I'm tearing out my hair as I see the television reports about this. I'll be honest, not so much with the fate that she met, but with the fact that her parents let her go down there, largely unsupervised, although there was some cursory supervision. You know, Aruba is just 16 miles from South America. It is the happiest island. Beautiful, but what are parents doing sending their kids on spring break, on senior trips, unsupervised to Caribbean countries where we know what's going to happen there? I'd like your reaction to the story. I know what my reaction is. Parents are sending their children into the wolf's den. That's coming up in the third hour. The other question I have for you during open lines, the headline in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today, Evangelist Graham expects New York Revival to be his last. Well, who's the next Billy Graham? Who will take Billy Graham's place that he's occupied in this nation? Who do you think it will be? Who do you think it should be? Answer those questions in the third hour of Issues, Etc., and give us a call, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Chris Mino is executive director of the Massachusetts Family Institute. He joins us to talk about the Massachusetts governor's recent announcement regarding a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage and civil unions. Chris, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Good to be with you.
Chris, what will this ban, this constitutional amendment, mean, and what does it mean that Mitt Romney has said he will support it?
Well, this new attempt at a constitutional amendment is our initiative to go with a citizen's petition instead of a legislative petition. That requires us to go out and gather 66,000 certified signatures. Then we have to get it through the legislature two sessions in a row and then to the voters. But this process, we are guaranteed that the petition stays the way we worded it. The legislature would be very hard for them to change it. And it's much easier to get through the legislature as I only need 25% approval, 50 votes, as opposed to the other one, which requires 51%. Having said all that, that's the route that we've chosen now to fix a problem in Massachusetts, both to end gay marriage and also to defeat the current amendment that is on the dock right now, which, if it's passed, would establish civil unions. So that's our overall strategy, and the governor today has endorsed that strategy. So we have got a lot of momentum back in the Bay State.
So what would have to happen with the voters of Massachusetts, and what would be the kind of time frame? Give us a picture of the steps that are being taken here in order to amend the Constitution of Massachusetts.
Well, again, I hate to give a tutorial, but there are two ways. One is through a legislative amendment, which is the ongoing process right now, but the legislature twisted that up where our original proposal would have banned civil unions. They recrafted it to establish full civil unions fully equal to marriage. So we don't want that amendment. So we have to defeat that this fall, and without our support, we're sure it's going to be defeated. And as I said, we are now going with a citizen's petition, which simply deals with marriage being between a man and a woman, period. Very easy for the voters to vote on it and understand it. We have to get, like I said, 66,000 signatures this fall, and then it has to go through 2 years of legislative voting, and then it goes to the voters in 2008.
So why is the governor's support for this, Mitt Romney's support for this, symbolic, or would this require the governor's support for it to actually become a valid amendment to the Constitution?
No, it's an amendment is strictly in the control of the legislature. The governor's support is strictly, commending it and providing his support and endorsement of it.
Why, if Massachusetts already has legal, full-blown gay marriage, why was this previous amendment tampered with, as you say, to support civil unions? If you've already got gay marriage, why do you need civil unions?
Well, the amendment that's in the process right now, it does define marriage as being between a man and a woman. So it would, if it passed, end the gay marriages. But it also would establish civil unions fully equal to marriage, which we believe won't pass the test with the voters because it's a very confusing issue to vote. It's like asking to vote for John Kerry and George Bush on the same ticket. And then we don't believe it could stand the constitutional muster because it violates the Supreme Court ruling of separate but equal on the 14th Amendment.
What, if successful, would become of the marriages that have already been performed in Massachusetts? Some for Massachusetts residents, others for people out of state. What would become of those gay marriages that are now legal but under this amendment would become illegal?
Those marriages would continue to exist. They would be literally grandfathered and eventually die off. We have to move forward from this point on to try to reverse this bad law decision that was mandated from the courts would take millenniums. And so this is the quickest, simplest process to get us back on track. And basically, we just have to accept the mistakes of the last that will have happened for 3 years.
Is this a last resort for dealing with legalized gay marriage in Massachusetts?
Yes, it is, albeit Perhaps someday a federal marriage amendment, and I should retract that. We have great hopes for a federal marriage amendment eventually being passed, but that's still going to be a number of years away for total ratification, I would think. Besides, we can't just wait for the cavalry from Washington to come rescue us. The good citizens of Massachusetts have got to continue to fight the good fight. Homosexual marriage has planted a stake in the heart of Massachusetts, and we've got to do everything we can to pull it out.
What do you think the average resident in Massachusetts thinks about the court's decision several years ago to enact gay marriage by force of fiat, and what do you think they think about the proposed constitutional amendment to ban it?
Well, according to the pollsters, it's 50-50. But perhaps I live in an ivory tower, but every gas station attendant I strike up a conversation with, or the man or the woman on the street, they all roll their eyes over this issue in disgust and bewilderment as to the existence of gay marriages. And so we believe that given the opportunity, very similar to Oregon, before last November, the polls were saying it was a 50-50 situation. Once the levers were pulled in the voting booth, it was 58% for traditional marriage. And we believe the same will hold true here. Plus, this new involvement of the governor, and of course today's our first day of formally announcing our new strategy and the formation of a ballot question committee to pursue this new amendment. We've got the high ground in the media, and the grassroots are getting energized again. So we believe we're off to a great start.
What kind of reaction have you received so far, albeit hours after the announcement was made?
I haven't been off the phone all afternoon. The wires are buzzing. It's both statewide and national news, of course, because of the governor's involvement. So we're quite pleased with that.
Finally, do you think that we are watching here, Chris, a preview in Massachusetts of how this issue is going to unfold judicially, legally, philosophically, when, of course, it will, at the federal level, reach the dockets of courts and our federal legislature?
Well, certainly 200 years ago, the eyes of the world were upon Massachusetts, and it's happening again. I certainly hope that the fine tradition of the Minute Men and Minute Women, as I like to say today, will continue, of people really rallying and taking on this tyranny head on. That's the tradition, that's our history, that's the legacy of Massachusetts, as well as the foundation stones of our nation have such deep roots in the wonderful work of the founding fathers of this state and this nation, believing, standing on the word of God and on firm Judeo-Christian foundation. The Great Awakening started here in 1740, and we're really crying out and believing that God once again will restore the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Chris Mino is Executive Director of Massachusetts Family Institute. Chris, thank you very much for the update, and I'm certain we'll be talking with you in the future as this story unfolds.
Absolutely, Todd, and thanks to everyone out there in the heartland that continues to not give up on us, but keep us in your prayers.
Chris Mino. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Moving from that subject to our next subject here, in just a moment, I invite your questions and comments as well. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I don't know. I think we are watching a bit of a microcosm of how this is going to play out. I don't think Massachusetts is that unique. I mean, judicial activism is a common problem. The legislature does routinely exhibit a weak will when it comes to dealing with these kind of issues, at least a mixed message. And a constitutional amendment is just that much harder to achieve at the federal level as it is at the state. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Birdie is calling from St. Louis. Birdie, welcome. Hey,
hello?
Birdie, would you turn down your radio, please?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I know that's how it always has to happen, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, there you go.
All right, what's your question or comment?
All right, well, my comment is, and this is actually what frustrates me more than anything, is the fact is I have had several very good friends who have grown up in with their parents being homosexual and having no problems whatsoever at point to this time. And actually, they are in heterosexual relationships right now. What my problem is the fact that we are so concerned about that particular issue and putting them in a homosexual home as opposed to all of the abuse and neglect that goes on in heterosexual families that is not being addressed. Because I would rather see a child go into a very safe home where there's, you know, they may be same sex, but they're responsible enough to introduce them to, you know, the opposite sex and give them that nurturing effect than to be in an abusive environment, because I really feel like a lot of Christians and a lot of organized religions do not want to accept the fact that abuse is occurring within our culture.
Well, I, no one's going to be in favor of putting children in abusive situations. No one would. But is the only alternative to put them in same-sex relationships as adoptive children? Yesterday, we did a tremendous program with Greg Rogers. He had written an article for the Christian Research Journal on gay adoption. And to tell you the truth, Birdie, at the very most we can say, the jury is still out on how healthy an environment a same-sex marriage or union would be for an adoptive child. In fact, the evidence seems to show, based upon what Rogers has looked into, that caution is recommended when it comes to the whole issue of gay adoption. So what have I said here? It's not an either-or. It's not, well, if we put them in these into heterosexual couples, they might suffer abuse, but if we give them to kind and loving homosexual couples, then all will be well. First of all, not every heterosexual couple will inflict abuse. What's the job then? The job is to give them to parents who are good parents to these children. And more research is needed before we automatically conclude that while there may be no real abuse taking place, that it's a healthy environment for children to be raised with same-sex parents. Eric Williford is a participant in the Crusade for Life walk across the Great Lakes. He joins us from Chicago to talk about a protest at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops meeting in Chicago over pro-choice Catholic lawmakers, a subject we've talked about here many times on Issues Etc. Eric, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the protest here that's taking place. What is the basic message?
Sure. Well, the protest is basically this, and it's not even so much, I don't really like to call it a protest. So I just like to say that, I mean, what we're doing out here is we're just trying to show a presence, number one, in support of our bishops. We love our bishops. I mean, our bishops are direct and immediate successors to the apostles. And what we're doing, number one, we're showing them how much we love them. And number two, what we're doing is, you know, we're trying to encourage them. We have 72 pro-abortion politicians. And they claim to be Catholic, yet they support the killing of children. And so what we're doing, Canon Law 915, what it says is anyone who supports, who is an obstinate, who persists in supporting abortion, sorry, it's a little bit hard to hear out here, I'm on the street with trains and buses. Anybody who persists publicly, again, or for abortion, that they not be allowed to receive Holy Communion. I think the important distinction is to make it's not a sanction. I mean, it's not a penalty. The reason the Catholic Church has that law is because we as Catholics believe the Eucharist, the bread and wine that we receive in communion, is the actual body and blood of Christ. Now, to receive that in an unworthy manner is you'll be guilty of profaning the body and blood of the Lord, according to St. Paul.
Eric, I appreciate the things you said about the bishops there and your support for them. Do you think that the bishops possess the will to actually carry out what you're talking about there? And that is essentially saying to Roman Catholic lawmakers, if you will stand in opposition to the church's teaching and scripture's teaching on life, then you will not be permitted to receive the sacrament. Do you think the bishops have the will to do this?
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact, and I think they already have. And I think the bishops have been very prudent about it so far. I mean, what they're doing is they're, when they're talking to these politicians, now I'm from St. Louis, so I'm a very, I talk, you know, a lot with Archbishop Burke. And, you know, for instance, he had talked to a politician privately, and this politician decided to go public with what the Archbishop Burke had said to him regarding receiving Holy Communion. That's the reason why it's become such a public issue. And then he had, you know, pretty much he either had to put up or shut up, which obviously everybody knows his stance on it. But the bishops, I mean, to be honest with you, I wouldn't want their job. I mean, they have a tremendous amount of responsibility as the shepherd of thousands of souls. And I do believe that they have the willpower to do that. The question comes down to not just the issue of, I mean, the issue here is really that these pro-abortion politicians are supporting abortion publicly. Now, canon law does state that. Now, canon law obviously is not to be interpreted by, you know, the laypersons. It's to be interpreted by the bishops only. But there are some politicians who publicly support abortion, and they do so with more fervor than others. And now when you get to a bigger archdiocese, it's a little bit harder to carry out canon law regarding the reception of communion. And the bishops, I mean, I believe are doing everything they can, and we're just out here to show them that, yeah, we support that they are upholding canon law 915. And for those that are kind of on the fence, we're, you know, we're letting them know that we support whatever decision they make, because ultimately, you know, the Crusade for Life is loyal to the Catholic bishops.
How do you respond to, and this has come from several prominent Roman Catholic lawmakers who are pro-choice, they'll say, this is this one from John Kerry when he was running for president. Look, he says, I believe life begins at conception, but for me, that's an article of faith. It's a part of my religious beliefs. And as a man who represents more than just Catholics, I can't impose an article of faith on them legislatively. How do you respond to that?
Actually, I think it's absurd, really. I mean, life is not an article of faith. I mean, for him to say he believed life begins at conception, yet publicly can't support that, I mean, really does nothing for the 3,500 babies who are dying every day by abortion, surgical abortion. The funny thing is you hear a lot of them say, I support a woman's right to choose. Well, they support a woman's right to choose to kill her child, and nobody will finish the statement. Nobody wants to take it that far. I mean, I'm all for having a choice, but I also support stop signs and, you know, traffic lights in the streets so nobody kills each other. But, I mean, it's a cowardly stance, number one. I mean, for anybody to say that that's an article of faith, I don't know how life could be an article of faith, because a fundamental right is the right to life. Without that, I mean, any other right is meaningless.
We're talking with Eric Williford. He's a participant in the Crusade for Life Walk Across the Great Lakes, joining us from Chicago. It's a demonstration at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops meeting in Chicago over pro-choice Catholic lawmakers. When we come back from this break, we'll continue our conversation with Eric, and we'll be talking about the involvement of Senator Dick Durbin, an ad running in today's Chicago Sun-Times with Dick Durbin's picture prominently featured. Senator Durbin, you can't be Catholic and pro-abortion. We'll talk about that ad. And we'll continue to talk about this demonstration. Then, to round off the second hour of Issues Etc. today, Robbie Sweeney joins us to talk about polygamy. He is personally involved in a case of polygamy that isn't making the news, as other polygamists are, like Warren Jeffs. The mother of Robbie's four-year-old daughter, estranged mother, has entered a plural marriage to an independent polygamist in Utah. He'll tell us his story and his thoughts on polygamy there. You know, there is some inaction on the part of the AG in Utah over these smaller cases. We'll talk about that next.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
What we do in times like this is pay close attention and recognize in it God's alien work to drive us to Jesus.
Pastor Matt Harrison, Executive Director of LCMS World Relief, on what Christians should know during times of disaster.
We should rejoice over our relationship with Christ, over our relationship with our family. We should speak forgiveness to those whom we have sinned against and those who have sinned against us. We should be quick to think about eternal things and not the ridiculous things that ball us up and bog us down, which are necessary for life, but rejoice in the eternal verities which sustain us.
For more information about LCMS World Relief, go to the Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org, or call 314-996-1683, LCMS World Relief.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Terry Phillips, sitting in for Bob Dittmer. 2 months after the death of Terry Schiavo, the autopsy results have been released. The attorney for her husband, Michael, said he was confident the report would show no evidence that Terry was abused before she collapsed in 1990. Kim Troby reports.
Medical examiner John Thogmartin announced the results.
Did she have a heart attack? Mrs. Schiavo's heart was anatomically normal, without any areas of recent or remote infarction. Was she strangled? No evidence of strangulation was found.
Dr. David Stevens, executive director of the Christian Medical Association, says the results may not show what really happened.
You cannot rule out that type of trauma 15 years after the fact by an autopsy.
After reading through the results several times, Dr. Stevens says the most surprising statement was that Terry couldn't have been fed food or water by mouth.
It doesn't make any sense that you can draw that conclusion for an autopsy unless her esophagus was completely blocked or something like that.
Repeated attempts by Terry's parents to have an independent autopsy were denied. Carrie Gordon Earle of Focus on the Family Action says that should not have happened.
I don't think anyone can look at this autopsy in light of those requests being denied and sleep well tonight to believe that all the answers that could have been gleaned were.
Regardless of the results, Earle says there is a bigger issue at hand.
The autopsy does not answer the fundamental moral question in this case, and that is, should a profoundly disabled but physically healthy woman be denied food and fluids?
She says there are so many holes and problems in this case that a simple autopsy is not the final resolution to the moral dilemma. For Family News in Focus, I'm Kim Troby.
Terry was denied food and water during the final days of her life. The autopsy says official cause of death was dehydration, a result that was expected. For Family News in Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
Have you tried and failed to live a purpose-driven life? Do your attempts to live a life that is pleasing to God fall so far short that you'd rather stay home from church? Then join Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, where the focus isn't on you, but on Christ, who was made sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God in Him. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church is located at 612 North State Street in Freeburg. Their phone number, 618-539-5664.
Don't let the title fool you. You don't have to be Lutheran to benefit from our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June. It's titled The Lutheran Book of Prayer. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about the Lutheran Book of Prayer on our website, issuesetc.org. The Lutheran Book of Prayer costs $8.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're discussing this demonstration at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops meeting being held now in Chicago over pro-choice Catholic lawmakers. Eric Wilford is our guest. He's a participant in this demonstration. Eric, an ad is running in today's Chicago Sun-Times featuring a big picture of Senator Dick Durbin, naming him as one of 72 pro-abortion Catholics in Congress, saying you can't be Catholic and pro-abortion. It's obvious why you would single out Durbin, but what's the message here, not only to the lawmakers, but also to other Catholics who are not lawmakers, but also pro-choice?
Well, the issue is simple. I mean, Cardinal Ratzinger, who's now Pope Benedict XVI, you know, said it best, the Catholic Church is not a democracy. You know, truth isn't voted on. In this country, we seem to have a lot of people who tend to think that, you know, there's no such thing as moral absolutes, and they subscribe to the theory of moral relativism. And unfortunately, that's not the case, and that's the heading that the issue of abortion falls under. I mean, the right to life is absolute. You can't take that away. For anybody who is Catholic and continues to support abortion, what they really need to do is research the issue. Generally, you know, what you see in the media and a lot of the newspapers tend to support abortion. But I would encourage everybody just to research the issue. I'm not saying what way to go, although I know what I would like to see them do. But, you know, for me specifically, it came about through a lot of research, a lot of prayer, obviously, but then, you know, a lot of research, a lot of study, and it just started to make sense. I mean, it was almost kind of absurd that I had never researched the issue any sooner. As far as the public figures, I think that's probably the biggest problem because they do this publicly, and a lot of people do look up to the lawmakers. I know you hear a lot of jokes and things like that about them, but ultimately they are our representatives that we put there, and what they really need to do is start standing up for the people who can't stand up for themselves, namely the unborn. And I mean, that's really their job. I mean, the fundamental right is the right to life, and they need to be fighting for that, especially for those who can't fight for themselves.
Last week, Eric, we had opportunity to talk with Democratic Congressman from Illinois, Jerry Costello. He has a 100% pro-life record. I asked him the question, what role does your Catholic faith play in your positions on life? Here's what he had to say.
Well, you know, I've been asked that many times. I'm a Roman Catholic. I went to Catholic grade school and high school and 2 years of college, and I have to tell you that it had a great deal of influence over me concerning my views on life as well as my views on a lot of other issues. So when people say to me, well, the reason that you're pro-life is because you're a Catholic, I say to them that that is not the case, but I have to tell you that the way that I was raised in my family and in my religion, it has had an effect on my views, not only on life, but every other aspect of life as well. So it's played a role, and hopefully it is will continue to play a role for the rest of my life, and it's something that I'm proud of.
Eric, your response to what the congressman had to say there?
Well, I think number one is he's very courageous with it. You know, you hear a lot about the separation of church and state, and I think a lot of people might try to use that argument against, you know, the senator's statements there, but you know, the separation of church and state, I mean, really what that means is Congress shall make no law prohibiting anyone acting according to his or her religious beliefs. I mean, if you do your history, you know, you'll find out what happened in England before we became a country. But, you know, for somebody to do that, it's, you know, your faith is not another part of your life. Your faith is your life, you know, for the people who are, I guess, for the people who would call themselves Christians. And ultimately, we're going to be, you know, called to an account for that. And, I mean, not even as a part of faith. I mean, even for somebody who, I guess, would say that they have no religious background or they are of no religion. You know, again, the issue is life. I mean, you either support it or you don't. And obviously that senator supports it. And I commend him for it. I mean, it's a very courageous statement, and we need more people like it.
How do you respond to another approach that's taken by pro-choice Catholic lawmakers? In this case, this was Mario Cuomo, who basically says, look, I prefer the indirect approach. He doesn't like abortion, he says, but he says the best way to go about this is the indirect approach. Maybe not direct legislative action, but we'll talk about things that kind of deal with the periphery of making it more safe, more rare, and yet keep it legal. How do you respond to that indirect approach advocated by some Roman Catholic lawmakers?
Actually, it's ridiculous. I mean, to say that some children are expendable and some aren't is ridiculous. I mean, that's really all there is to say about that. I mean, is there ever a time where killing a child is right? Is there any time where a child is expendable, where the taking of one human life is okay, especially one who's as helpless as an unborn child would be? Now, there are other people who might use the argument, well, when does life begin? Well, I mean, science has said over and over and over they believe it begins at conception. Some aren't sure. But until we get, you know, some kind of uniformity with that question, I mean, you should err on the side of caution and believe that life begins at conception.
Two quick final questions here. Is the bigger problem here Roman Catholic lawmakers who are simply Catholic on their own terms?
The bigger problem as far as what?
Well, is this pro-choice lawmakers, as bad as it is, a symptom of kind of, I'm going to be Catholic, but I'm going to be Catholic on my own terms. This I like about it, this I don't like about it, and who's to tell me any different?
Well, that is a good question. There are a lot of Catholics who want to be Catholic on their own terms, and, you know, unfortunately, that's just not how the Catholic Church is. I mean, the Catholic Church, it's been around for 2,000 years, and it's been around for 2,000 years not because it's popular or because it's changed with the times or anything like that. I mean, The Catholic Church has been around, and they've never wavered on their teachings as far as morals and values go. You know, no other country or empire or religious institution has been around that long who hasn't changed their teachings. I mean, so I don't know how somebody can say I can be Catholic on my own terms. I mean, you know, that's essentially that's what part of the Reformation was about. And, you know, 500 years later, we have 30,000 different denominations and one Catholic Church. I mean, if they want to start their own church, you know, go ahead. But, you know, the Catholic Church is not a cafeteria. You don't go in and pick and choose what you like and then just disregard the rest. I mean, I don't know how anybody could say that, really. But I think it is a big issue when you have public figures that are doing that. It does make it a little bit easier for other people to do it, and I think, you know, the fight begins with the public figures.
Well, I will respectfully disagree, Eric, that that was what the Reformation about. I think it had more to do with bringing the pure and unadulterated gospel to light. I speak as a Lutheran there. So, but finally, is further statement or action needed from Pope Benedict XVI on this?
Well, to be honest with you, everybody knows what the Catholic Church teaches. Everybody knows Benedict XVI's stance on it. I mean, the way the church is run, and you know, I'm not sure how much of this you've gotten into as a Lutheran, but you know, the Pope has given teaching authority to the bishops. He leaves it up to them, and ultimately, the bishops leave it up to the pastors of those parishes, you know, with what to do with regards to public figures and that kind of thing. Although I don't think much else is needed, but I would definitely expect to see Pope Benedict XVI come out with several things regarding the gospel of life. I mean, John Paul II has done a lot of work regarding you know, the sanctity of life. And I would even look to see Pope Benedict XVI do some things as far as maybe some other social issues as far as like pornography and contraception and things like that, other issues that a lot of people think are Catholic but are intricately related to the sanctity of life.
Eric Wilford has joined us from Chicago to talk about this demonstration at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops meeting there in that city over pro-choice Catholic lawmakers. Eric is a participant in that, and thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc., Eric.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
To round off today's conversation here in the second hour, Robbie Sweeten joins us. We're going to be talking about not only his story as it pertains to polygamy, but also whether or not polygamy is really being rooted out as a legal issue. Everywhere it's found, you read about Warren Jeffs, you read about leaders of larger groups where polygamy is practiced or encouraged. Well, that's not the only place it's happening. Robbie Sweeten joins us. Robbie, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Tell us your story as it pertains to polygamous marriage.
Well, let me just inform the general public of the situation here in Utah. There are currently over 40,000 polygamists in Utah, or probably more. Let's just call them Mormon fundamentalists. It's an epidemic. The Attorney General states they don't have the resources. I've contacted the Attorney General and asked what tree I have to rattle in order to get them the resources, and they say legislature on a state level as well as a federal level. The cases we have here, I mean, Warren Jeffs is a problem, but that's nothing in comparison to the cases that are slipping through right now. One is a girl named Rachel Strong, who was 17 or 18 years old, forced to marry a 65-year-old and told that she would go to hell for 1,000 years if she didn't marry him. Another case is 600 birth certificates were dropped on the Attorney General's desk approximately a month ago, and seven brothers are responsible for 600 birth certificates. That's the kind of problems we're having here. My particular case is my girlfriend was Anna Zella Swapp, who was the eldest daughter of Adam Swapp, who was part of the Singer Swapp compound. He blew up a Mormon church in the 80s, and this was all from God. He wrote a letter to the state, stated, John Singer warned you people in the name of Jesus Christ to stop your actions against him. You cared not for these warnings, and now you will reap the whirlwind of destruction. The Lord has told me that I should declare these things unto you for a wise purpose in him. I have also been told by my God that you men are past forgiveness and will be destroyed. So essentially, he took on the federal government, which was supposed to fall, and Mr. John Singer was supposed to be risen from the dead and protect the family, which was the longest siege in U.S. history, a 13-day siege before Ruby Ridge. The girl that I that my girlfriend, which I have I'm doing a custody battle with against my, is for my 4-year-old. She did not believe in this religion until 6 months ago. She just woke up and said, "I'm going to follow my beliefs," and left. She was married, or she was engaged within a month. She was married within 2 months and pregnant within a little over 3 months. She called me crying when she realized I had a little bit more information than she would care to as far as the court cases go. And I asked her if she loved him, and she said, "No, but God told me to marry him. I know you won't understand that, but God told me to marry him." I said, "That wasn't my question. Do you love him?" And she said, "No, but Melinda, his other plural wife, didn't love him at first either." And she cried a little more, and then she said, "I can't break my covenants, Robbie. I'll go to hell." So now here she is stuck in a lifestyle, and she's pretty much been washed as far as mainstream society goes, what her beliefs are, and ideally, it really looks like she doesn't even love the gentleman. My case is getting a lot of attention because I'm the first man to speak out in a long time, but the problem is my case is in California, and they're just not recognizing polygamy as an issue in a custody battle. So the fate of my daughter relies on, one, a custody evaluator with this PhD in psychology. So that's fearsome, man. That's scary.
Now, added to this, of course, you mentioned your 4-year-old daughter. Is it true that in families that practice and religious groups that practice polygamous marriage in Utah, the marriages are not all only polygamous, but they are also often with underaged, even minor daughters and women?
That's an understatement. There are cases. In fact, Tom Green got prosecuted for impregnating a 17-year-old. The problem was he actually married her when she was 13 years old. So, I mean, you know, you decide the moral factor on that. I mean, that's just horrible. That's just scary.
What do you think about the fact that high-profile cases like Warren Jeffs, you mentioned Green there as well, are often very much read about, very much known to the public, whereas, and yours is now known, but whereas smaller cases, individual cases like yours, not only pass under the public's radar, but also under, apparently, the Attorney General's radar in Utah?
Well, I spoke to them earlier today. The Paul Murphy is the media representative for the Attorney General's office, and in defense to the Attorney General's office, they are overwhelmed. I asked them, when they say they don't have enough resources, I asked them, was it money specifically or was it personnel specifically, and what tree do I have to rattle to make things happen? While this may be a small case to you, this is the biggest case in my daughter's life and mine. And he said, we can't go after every bigamist or polygamist case, just as we can't go after every case of sodomy or adultery, which are both illegal in the state of Utah as well. They have pushed it to be a second degree felony in some cases to move the charges up to 13 years in prison. But the bottom line is, even though Anazella Swap, my daughter's mother, actually in a court of law in the state of California admitted that she was in a polygamous relationship, and she or plural relationship is what they like to call it, it didn't matter. It did not matter. They're not going to prosecute it, and because they're not going to prosecute it, the state of California is not going to do anything either in regard to the case. I think the most upsetting thing is their whole objective has been to drown me financially. And as ironic as it is, this particular group lives in little cave dwellings in Moab, Utah. They've blasted out the wall of a cliff. They have a 50-year lease of Bureau of Land Management land. which is government land. They pay $1,200 a month, or $1,200 a year, excuse me, and there's probably 60 people living out there. They deliver mail via subcontract through the U.S. Postal Service. So essentially they have government jobs and they live on government land, and this is the government, the very government, which they state is evil and corrupt and has fallen from God.
Do you have any custody agreement at this point with regard to your four-year-old daughter?
It is a temporary custody order it's just for evaluation purposes. There is a custody evaluation that's supposed to take place. However, the judge handpicked his custody evaluator. It's costing me $5,200 a day to have the evaluator come out to Utah because I said there's no reason to have any evaluation unless you're actually going to go to the polygamous community. But being that, you know, it's going to be pretty much a case of the Stepford Wives. When they go out there, everyone will be, you know, shiny, happy people. It's not a good situation. Even more saddening than mine, my case is tiny, but the group Tapestry Against Polygamy, there's only a couple nonprofit organizations that are helping women and children escape polygamy. And there's just a constant flux of people. I mean, when someone shows up at your door with eight children, or a woman shows up at your door with eight children and has no social skills from being in one of these groups, it takes a lot of resources they go through a lot of therapy and they have to learn how to work and be a part of society again. And no one's coming forth with donations as far as time or resources in the state of Utah. I would love to ask the general public to go, I mean, not for me personally, but for these women and children, as far as the righteous thing goes, go to tapestryagainstpolygamy.org and see what you can do personally. There's Mormon polygamists in, I think, 9 or 10 states currently. Utah's got 40,000, but they still need places to go. They still need people to donate time and resources. Even $5 to some of these people can make all the difference in the world.
Now, you mentioned their Tapestry and what they do to help women escape polygamous marriages. How difficult is it for a woman who wants to get out of this situation to actually get out and permanently stay out of it?
Well, the biggest problem is the indoctrination starts, and a lot of them are, like, for instance, in my case, we're talking third-generation polygamists. So, and they're taught that, the outside world is evil, and the way they usually work is they choose and keep the group away in these places that are, like, for instance, where my ex lives. It's called The Rock. You can stand on top of that where they live and look in all directions. You're not going to see anything for 30 miles. So they keep them isolated, and they tell them, basically they told me to let go of my wicked worldly ways and join them. I said no. Is what happens with the women is they're told if they break their covenants, they'll go to hell. So ideally is what happens is they finally get to the point to where the conditions are so bad for their children and or themselves that they choose, I'll take the chance of going to hell than rather stay in this environment. Tapestry doesn't actually go in and pull people out of the polygamous groups. They're basically the hand that stands there and is there for these women who finally attain the courage to actually get out. There was a 13-page paper written by a Dr. Larry Beal, B-E-A-L-L. Excuse me, yeah, that's correct. And it's The Impact of Modern-Day Polygamy on Women and Children. And if you read it, I mean, there aren't many religions out there that are listed as cults as much as fundamentalist Mormonism. And the impact on children and women is just overwhelming. It's just, I really don't think there are very many religions that are even close to the trauma and the psychological damage. It takes years and years for them to get away from their disassociative symptoms and establishing safety, because they always have a fear that the leaders and or their ex-husband or what have you is going to come after them. And a lot of times the groups have quite a bit of financial money because the groups live in poverty, and not all of them, but all the money goes to the leader, the prophet. And as what happens is, if the prophet so chooses, they create a court battle which drowns the single mother, or in my case, the single father, to where they can't afford to pay for the legal services.
Could part of the reticence, and I agree that the Attorney General's office has got to be completely overwhelmed, but could part of the reticence of other lawmakers, other people of power in Utah to deal with polygamy, as big a problem as it is in that state and elsewhere, could part of it be, well, that they don't want to give Mormonism in general, non-polygamous Mormonism, a bad name by going after fundamentalist Mormons?
Well, I gave, or I asked in a media announcement yesterday for the members or the upper members of the church to stand up. I essentially, you know, I said that when people think of Utah, they don't think of Utah, the land of Zion, as a place where, I mean, the church itself is one of the biggest donors of charity in the world. I'm not a Mormon, but I mean, you know, I mean, the fact be told, they donate more money than almost any religion in the world to people in Africa or Asia or what have you. And but people don't outside of Utah don't see it that way. They see polygamous groups and self-titled prophets like Adam Swapp being directed by God to take on the government and the church. And they see a place where, as I said before, the seven brothers responsible for 600 birth certificates, Warren Jeff. It's time for them. Over 90% of all the offices, and not that you're supposed to ever mix religion with offices, but 90% of everyone in office in Utah is Mormon, whether it be on a state level or a county level. And there's no way to get around that. At what point does the Mormon church begin to influence the black eye that's been created by the fundamentalists?
So in other words, it's in the LDS's best interest to distinguish itself and individual members insofar as they're lawmakers or event shapers to distinguish themselves from fundamentalist polygamous Mormonism.
Well, they try. And in fact, during the Olympics, the prophet, I believe Kimball is his name, actually spoke to the world media regarding polygamy and disavowed it and said it wasn't part of their religion and what have you. But still, if the general public does not stand up, tell their legislatures, tell their county representatives, tell their state representatives, and even their federal representatives to do something, then nothing is done. You can go on websites right now that are just burning up because of the issues that are in place right now as far as Warren Jeff's go, my case and Rachel Strong's case, and there'll be 20 blogs on there, and you'll get one negative, and everyone is against it, but no action is taken. And in other words, you know, if you're not going to take action and you're just going to speak, then nothing's going to happen. So the general public has to make it happen, and it's not going to happen unless everyone stands up.
Robbie Sweeten is our guest. The mother of Robbie's 4-year-old daughter has entered a plural marriage to an independent polygamist in Utah. Robbie, thanks for being our guest.
A pleasure. Really appreciate you taking the time. And
happy
God
to do
bless.
It. Happy to do it. There's a great resource on polygamy, Tapestry Against Polygamy, their website, polygamy.org. We'll be right back with the third hour of Open Lines, Issues, etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, etc. Issues, etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.